Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Rory Heath. Hi, Rory.
Hi, how's it going?
Great, thank you. Thank you for coming on. I'm excited to have you. So Rory is a fourth year medical student at King's College London and he's a writer. He's has his own blog and he also writes for the Strength and Conditioning Research website, which I will link to in the show notes for this podcast. But Rory, can you tell us about your interest in medicine and how you got started with medical school?
Okay, so I study in the UK. So we have our application processes when we're 17 or 18, then we apply to medical school. So when I applied, I was still really quite young.
You look young now in your picture. How old are you?
I'm 22.
22, you look really young. That's a good thing. You'll appreciate that later.
It's taken a while ago. I haven't got around to changing it yet. Yeah, so I was 17 when I applied to medical school. And I applied because of my background in sports and my general interest in the human body, how it works and how it goes wrong. That's my interest in medicine has changed over the years throughout medical school. We can talk about that, I suppose, later. But so in terms of my sporting background, I used to play a lot of rugby. And so I've been quite closely attuned to how my body works when I'm training in the gym or on the pitch. And then also I've had all the injuries as well. So I've come into contact with the NHS and the health services and then the whole rehabilitation process and trying to get myself better. On a physical level. And then I also experimented with different types of diets and macronutrient ratios and things like that to try and get every little ounce of performance I could. So at home, so I could perform better on the pitch. That's why I applied to medical school. So I could learn about those areas a little bit more and then translate that into a career and helping other people and getting more involved into that.
And what qualifications did you need to get into medical school?
So because you're applying when you're in sixth form, it's just A-levels. So I did biology, chemistry and English. And in general, you need 3 A's to get to med school.
Oh, wow. That's quite an achievement. I'm sure that some people listening to this won't be familiar with the British system of academia. So A-levels are what you finish when you're 18 years old. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so you only do 3 or maybe 4 subjects. I mean, some people are doing 5 now. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, my brother completely eclipsed me. He's just applied to do computer science. I think that's like yourself.
Yeah, that's right. I have an undergraduate degree in computer science.
Yeah, so he's just applied to do that. And he has 5 A-levels. He does maths, further maths, physics, and then 2 others that I'm not sure about.
So tell me about King's College then. So for people listening, you probably won't know that King's College in London, it's on the Strand. It's a pretty amazing part of London. Is that why you chose King's College?
Yeah, it is. I chose it because it's one of the famous medical schools. It's got a really, really long history behind it. I chose it because of its location too. So it's got multiple campuses throughout London. It's got one at London Bridge, which is Guy's Hospital, St. Thomas's, which is just by Westminster. And it also has Denmark Hill, which is in South London. I chose it because it's part of the South Thames Deanery. So you are able to not only have the London hospitals, but be sent to peripheral hospitals down on the coast and explore. And so you can use those to explore areas of southern England. So I thought it would be a good place to go because it offers a wide variety of patients to see and many different demographics as well. And then that reflects the diseases that you come across. So for example, in South London, we have a large African population. And so the diseases in South London are more like sickle cell, and we get quite a lot of malaria too, which is not usual for the United Kingdom. But then if you're sent down to Chichester by the coast, then you get different diseases, different demographic.
Wow, that's so interesting. So where do you live at the moment? Are you living in London?
My student accommodation is in Peckham, so in South London, which is good fun. It's got a really, really big student community, but it's still able to. So I'm still able to get into central London really easily. Currently, I've moved back to my parental home in North London just because I'm in the run up to my written exams, and so I'm trying to get all the home comforts that I can.
Oh no, I'm sorry if I'm keeping you from revising. That's sorry.
This is a really good break.
Tell me about the structure of the degree then. So you're in your fourth year. Can you kind of give me a general overview of what the years were like year one? Year two, year three. When was it you first started seeing patients?
Typically, well, in the old days, you'd have the first 2 years being pure clinical sciences. So you're learning your physiology, biochemistry, and anatomy. And then you wouldn't see your patients until years 3, 4, and 5. That's changing in many medical schools. King's is still quite typical in that you have your two clinical years, but they've embraced seeing patients a little bit earlier. So throughout 1 and 2, you'd go to a GP practice and be allocated to them, and then you see a few patients. However, that was very rare, and you wouldn't really be able to have a doctor-patient relationship in any form. You get your true exposure to patients when you go to 3, 4, and 5. And so that's when your learning is very much based in the hospital setting. And then it's benefited also by lectures throughout the week. So as I'm in my 4th year, I've now had 2 years of seeing patients, and that's been through different rotations. So last year was largely general medicine, so looking at the abdomen, the chest, and also and the brain, so neurology. And this year has been more based on the different specialties. So I've just come off my reproductive and sexual health rotation. I've also done pediatrics, and I've done orthopedics and rheumatology as well. So I've had a really good broad sense of medicine over the last 2 years. The 5th year is kind of the consolidation year before finals. So it's based in 3 different rotations. One's in the community, in a GP practice. And so you're seeing very common medical problems, and you're able to, so it's a different field to hospital medicine. And the majority of people who go to medical school will end up being GPs. And so it's an essential part of our learning. The other two blocks are based in surgery and in medicine in the hospital. So that's just recapping everything we've learned over the first 2 years of clinics, years 3 and 4, and preparing for our final exams and our written exams and our final practical exam called an OSCE.
Tell me about some of the problems that you see in the hospital setting, especially in London. I'm really curious to see what to know about what you see in London.
I think every hospital has its problem of chronic disease. And so wherever you are, you'll have the same kind of bread and butter cases for each specialty. So if you're a respiratory doctor, then you have lots of COPD in the chronic setting. If you're a heart doctor, cardiologist, then you have lots of heart failure. Yeah, it's very much dominated by chronic disease within a hospital. It's quite amazing, really. You'll be in a ward and there won't be many acute cases. Many of the patients who are there will have exacerbations of a long-standing chronic condition, and that just needs looking after until they can be sent home. The exciting stuff happens in A&E. So that's when you have trauma. That's where orthopedics are based. You have anaphylactic reactions, heart attacks, strokes, things like that. That's a bit more dynamic and fast paced and a bit more scary. Some of the most medically interesting cases you find on the ward, though, so things that are based in the immune system, like rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma, different kind of autoimmune diseases that you see.
Okay, and you see those on the ward. And how much thought goes into what's causing those types of problems? And what are your thoughts on what's causing those problems?
Yeah, so we, in the UK, we're very much within the conventional approach to medicine, where we look at the pathophysiology of it and then try and use a drug to treat it. And so our thinking in the hospital doesn't really go much further than that. It's nowhere near the approach that functional medicine takes towards treating disease, where you're trying to look for a root cause and then treating the root cause and then looking to see if the symptoms resolve. It's also treating a patient when they've come in sick. So rather than taking a preventative approach within the community, the mainstay of our treatment is prescribing. So pharmacological treatments, medications and drugs. And then there's the rehabilitation side that goes on within the community that we don't get to see in the hospital.
And how successful is it in your eyes?
I think it's successful in that it completes what it sets out to do, which is bring patients back to their baseline and then manage the symptoms and stops the exacerbations. I don't think it's successful in completely removing the disease, because once you have a chronic disease such as COPD, you are never expected to return to normal. But ideally, you would have had an action put in place earlier, 20 years earlier, that would stop them getting COPD in the first place.
Okay. So you better explain what a COPD is.
Okay. So COPD is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It's a condition where you basically lose the function of your lungs to transfer gases. So you need oxygen when you breathe in, and that's essential for life, and you need to excrete carbon dioxide over your lungs as well. When you damage your lungs through things like smoking, you damage or you scar the barrier that the gases usually go over, and then you find it very difficult to exchange these gases, which means that you are hypoxic, so you haven't got enough oxygen within your blood, and you may retain carbon dioxide as well. So you end up being quite a sick patient. You gradually lose the function of your lungs to transfer oxygen and carbon dioxide, and you need more therapies to keep your airways open, and you may need like full-time oxygen therapy to make sure your body's getting enough. You're also more susceptible to infections and kind of traumatic problems within the lungs. So infections is a large cause of people being admitted to hospital with COPD.
So what's going on there? Are people smoking? Are they inhaling traffic fumes? Like, what's going on? What's causing that, do you think?
Oh, man, it's going to be multifactorial, definitely. There's so much research that's been gone into smoking. So I think that's probably the number one cause. Traffic fumes, they're ubiquitous, aren't they? They're in every city. And I haven't looked at the data, but I'm sure... Well, I expect that rates of COPD will be higher in people who are constantly exposed to these fumes. So yeah, it's just gradual lung damage that you get as you age and as you come across different pollutants.
Tell me about your interest in sports medicine. What does sports medicine look like for rugby players, say? Is it just the type of acute injury that they pick up on the field, or is there something that sports medicine can help with rugby players and their diet or body composition or their strength? So tell me about sports medicine.
Sports medicine's huge. You can attack it from different angles. The training pathway for sports medicine, you can either go through a surgical pathway. So you do your basic surgical training and then you qualify in sports medicine. So you'd be able to look at different sports injuries. So after someone's come in with an ACL, then you could address their injury in a kind of sports medicine fashion. You can do it through hospital medicine. So I know a rheumatologist who's also interested in sports medicine. So he will look at, so a rheumatologist is kind of joints, immune system, connective tissue and things like that. And so then he can look at sports medicine injuries through his lens. And you can do sports medicine as well through a GP setting, so family medicine in the American term. And then you're looking at common illnesses, common problems that humans go through, and then also having a sports medicine layer upon that. Within a rug, it depends which level of rugby you're talking about. If you're talking about a professional club, then the doctor will be working as part of a multidisciplinary team. So there'll be physiotherapists involved, there'll be personal trainers and strength and conditioning coaches, and probably nutritionists too. So the doctor is kind of like a jack of all trades, I suppose, and they're able to treat the medical problems that some of the other members of the team wouldn't be able to treat, and then bring everybody else together. So all the different aspects of the healthcare team within the sports setup are going to be influenced by the doctor's actions or wishes, I think. So a lot of it would just be managing, I think, a GP role, so looking at the general player health. But you can go more down the performance aspect. So you're looking at how the players are training and trying to monitor load and how they're performing on the pitch, how they're recovering, and then trying to predict an injury risk upon that. So that's kind of going beyond medicine. It's going more into strength and conditioning or physiotherapy.
And then where is this happening? At what level in rugby are we talking about? Is this at the elite level or is this happening?
So this would definitely be an elite level, because to get a team like that, you're going to have some considerable funding.
Right.
To have all of them going on at the same time and to have a facility as well. At a club level, so that's a kind of weekend club where you have lay people playing rugby. You wouldn't have any of that. You'd have a physiotherapist and a first aider. A sports medicine doctor doesn't have a setting there. For medical students, it's a good place to get experience. So I'm looking at getting a placement next year, just doing a regular gig at a rugby club and getting to know some of the common injuries and problems that go on at a rugby club. But so yeah, the high tech stuff is definitely the it's definitely exclusive to elite level rugby and sport. It's mostly, so rugby's catching up with football because football is huge in the UK and it has so much more money. So there are massive conferences and every kind of club is going to have a doctor and then a good team around them.
And tell me what you're seeing at the conferences. Like, what's hot at the conferences at the moment? Are they using heart rate variability to track the players' progresses, or what are the technologies that you see are hot at the moment at the conferences?
So the majority of the conferences are based on medical and surgical issues. So we see lots of ACL and then ACL injuries and how to repair them in the best way, and tendonitis, so they're chronic overuse injuries. They don't really address any dietary protocols you could use to prevent that injury in the first place. I'm not sure if there's the evidence base for that yet, but you're right. So there are quite a lot of... So you have the exhibitors at the conference that you go and talk to in the breaks, and there are loads of really interesting things. People definitely use cold, so not quite cold thermogenesis, but they're using cold packs and different kind of cold garments that they can use to shut down inflammation or increase blood flow within an injury. And they're using heart rate variability as well. It's kind of taking off. I think that clubs find it difficult to... So what I've heard from talking to the exhibitors is that clubs find it difficult to implement HRV on a large scale because they have so many members within the squad, and then it's compliance. They have compliance issues. People have their different schedules and things like that. In the past, they've just used resting heart rate rather than... So wake up and do your resting heart rate rather than HRV. But it's probably going to move towards HRV in the future as we... But it could do as we get to grips with the technology and improve an understanding within the clubs, so more people can access it.
And then tell me about the diet piece then. So this obviously really intrigues me for multiple reasons, but you just touched on that you might be able to prevent some of the injuries with dietary interventions. Did I hear that right? And what are your thoughts?
That's just my personal interest, really. So we always talk about diet and inflammation and things like that. Okay, so on a very superficial level, you need to make sure that you have enough protein, carbohydrate, fat, and calories to make sure that you're recovering after each training session, right? And then from that, you can look at your macronutrients as a whole. So I know that in Australia, the cricket team doctor over there is experimenting with high-fat, low-carb, and some of the players. Oh, there's one really prominent Australian rugby player. God. His name eludes me, but he's changed over to a high fat, low carb diet, and he says that he's recovering better and he feels better. His performance on the pitch has improved, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily expect, or conventional wisdom wouldn't expect that to happen. We're always told that if you play elite sport, then you need the carbohydrate to have your glycolytic burst to be able to run fast. But perhaps not so much. Perhaps it's not as important as we previously thought. And in terms of, so I mentioned earlier, tendons. A tendonitis or a tendinosis is kind of like a chronic inflammatory condition of the tendon where you have gradual buildup of damage and then either a catastrophic event where it ruptures or just niggling pain that goes on for a long time. They're really difficult to treat. And there are many different approaches and no one really knows how to do it best. There's a really common area of dispute when you go to a conference is how to treat it best. Is it surgical? Is it medical? Are you using steroids? Are you using PRP? Are you using just,
so what's PRP?
PRP is, what does it stand for? Protein rich plasma. So that's
right.
Do you know what it is?
I've heard of it. I don't really know what it is and how it's used.
So I'm certainly not an expert in this, but it's when but what I understand is that you take blood from the patient, you centrifuge it, and you extract the plasma from the blood sample, and then it's supposed to contain different kind of cytokines and growth factors that you inject into the area that's sore, and that might stimulate some sort of healing process. We're not sure if it's the PRP itself, or the fact that you're sticking a needle into an area and causing local inflammation. Right. That's the thing. It's massively disputed. And it depends the way you look. So, I know that one of the editors of the British Journal of Sports Medicine is strongly for having an open mind when looking at PRP and has done some really entertaining speeches or kind of talks at conferences in the past, completely debunking all the evidence that goes on with PRP. And then you have other people who are tied to other organizations that are very, very much for PRP as a treatment, and they can bring out their organization's evidence base for it. So it depends who you believe, depends whether you are going to invest your time into the research or not.
So let's talk about the role of inflammation and the diet then. You know, you talked a little bit about macronutrients. Do you think there's other things that the rugby players, for example, or football players or any other type of athlete could be eating that's causing inflammation that could be contributing to the injuries that you see on the pitch?
Yeah. So I haven't done any of my own research. These are my ideas of what I've learned and what I've read from other people. But we know that, we think that many people have sensitivities and intolerances to foods that are common in our diet. So, for example, gluten. You don't know. So if someone's eating a lot of gluten, carbohydrate is very common within performance sport. And if you have carbohydrate, it's likely to be coming from bread and pasta because they're because they're common and they're cheap and they're tasty.
Certainly used to eat a lot of bread and pasta in my days when I lived in London.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you're living on a budget as well. If you go to the supermarket and you're looking for a cheap source of nutrition, then readily available carbohydrate is definitely at the top of the list in terms of calories per per currency. And so if you have an elite athlete who has a large caloric demand and you have a club who's trying to feed them, and they're going to be downing lots and lots of potentially inflammatory food like gluten or wheat and things like that. So then that's going to be, if they're sensitive to it, then that could be feeding a low level intolerance or low level inflammation, which then could contribute to degeneration within a tendon. Similar for post-workout high carb drinks and sugar. Sugar has been linked to multiple different diseases on an inflammatory basis. So if it contributes to diabetes and if it contributes to heart disease because of inflammation, then why would it not contribute? Why couldn't we see a link where it contributes to inflammation within a tendon? The way I look at it is that they're all chronic diseases. They all show degeneration over time, and diet is one of those things that you carry with you from day one to the day you kick it. So if diet is one of those factors that stays with you for a long time, then why couldn't it be something that contributes to the chronic disease?
I'm really interested to know how much you learn about diet at medical school. So I've heard numerous doctors on numerous podcasts say that they had an hour of training on nutrition, or maybe even less, maybe even none.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say it's an hour of training. Like throughout medical school, you have the first 2 years of preclinical sciences, of which nutrition will be an hour or two. But then people didn't go to medical school to learn about nutrition. That's much too a bland a fix for someone's chronic disease. They want to know about all the
juicy stuff, sexy stuff.
Yeah, exactly. All the cool drugs and all the biotechnology and all the prostheses and like prosthetics and stuff like that. They're not going to want to know about fats, carbs, sugars and proteins. So King's did put on the lecture for us, but whether the full cohort of the year turned up, I doubt it. And the information that they gave us as well. So it would be like, what makes a protein? What makes a carbohydrate? How are they metabolized? We're very much focusing on glycolysis as our main source of energy. So breaking down carbohydrates into sugars and then sugars making ATP.
Sometimes, especially in the older discussions of biochemistry that I've seen, the glycolysis is almost synonymous with energy production, right? They don't ever consider that you could make energy out of anything other than glucose, which is just not true.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's the way medical school still is. So we are still still recommend carb loading and eating lots of carbohydrate as our main source of energy. And that's the only fuel we have. That's the fuel that our brain runs off. Ketones are associated with starvation and scary conditions like diabetic ketoacidosis, where you're in a really bad state and that can kill you. So it's tainted by a bad rep from that condition. And then we look at fat as a demonized nutrient that we should all be avoiding. The thing is they don't tell us any of the evidence base behind it. They just tell it to us on the lecture slides and we're expected to believe it. Well, we are.
And I would have done as well. To be fair, you know, the only reason I know that this might be wrong is because I've tried it and it didn't work for me. And then I've done my own homework afterwards and figured a few things out. But if I'd have been told this at medical school at your age, there's absolutely no way I would have questioned it. And the same thing happened to me at university when I did computer science. I never even thought for a moment that what I might be taught was wrong. It just didn't even cross my mind, and it wasn't. Everything they taught me was obviously correct, because that just doesn't happen in computer science. But yeah, what's the word I'm looking for? Cognitive dissonance, maybe is the right phrase. How do you even know that the problem exists? Is it just your exposure to the internet? You know, you can just do your own homework. But why would you do that? Like, if you've already got so much work to do
from
university, why would you spend your time reading articles about, you know, nutrition on the internet? I'm interested to know why you're doing that.
Yeah, that's true. So firstly, what I find scary is that if the nutrition is wrong, then what else is wrong? I'm not trying to promote any conspiracy theories here, but it's terrifying to think that something so broad as nutrition could be taught wrong, taught badly, and then everything we're doing is based upon that learning. But in terms of my background, so my initial interest in nutrition came from rugby and trying to get the best of my body on the pitch. So we were given nutrition lectures when I was part of an academy. So they would tell us, you know, have your protein afterwards and watch your fat and eat more carbs and carb load and drink Gatorade. We were sponsored by Gatorade. So drink Gatorade. But then I have an auntie as well, who's very much into nutrition and into functional medicine as well. She's just moved over to Sydney, so she's practicing out there. And she was a huge influence when I was a kid. So we have, I think my 16th birthday present was Nourishing Traditions by...
Oh, wow. Yeah, of course. Weston A. Price.
Yeah. So we've got that. And then subsequently I got Fermented Vegetables and Nourishing Broth and like all the Lustig books, Yudkin's book as well. So nutrition's, I've been biased towards it since early days.
So the knowledge, the Nourishing Traditions, it predates medical school. So this is the thing I wonder about. How do you not tear your hair out then every time you go and get taught some of this stuff, you know, the carb loading, energy is glucose, all of that kind of stuff. Do you not just want to, you know, go bananas in the lecture hall?
It's difficult. There was that occasion in first year when they gave us the lecture for the first time, and I sat with a group of friends and we happened to all be very similarly minded. No wonder we were friends. But we were just thinking about insulin and thinking about carbohydrate and as you said, tearing our hair out, like, what's going on? The entire year has been being taught this rubbish. But from then on, you can't... My medical school, so King's is one of the largest, or maybe it is the largest medical school in Europe. So in my year, in year one, there were 450 people in who were studying. And then just realized it's a huge problem. And then just me tearing my hair out is a bit of a futile thing to do. It's not going to solve anything. When I'm in a group-based discussion, then I'll just try and ask questions about what the speaker understands about it, and then propose or see what they think about a ketotic diet or a low-carb diet and how the physiology would adapt and how that could provide any disadvantages or advantages, just to seem like an idea or an alternative. But even then, if you do that, people breeze over it. They're not really worried. I don't think they see nutrition as important as I see it, or as people in this sphere see it.
So it's not even then, you know, I was wondering whether you maybe sent some studies to some of the lecturers, but it's not even really like you're being taught that much nutrition. So there's not really anyone to send studies to, I suppose.
Yeah, so we weren't taught our nutrition lectures by a nutritionist. We were taught by a GP who'd been pulled in to teach it. So... Yeah. So it didn't seem like it was the right place to fight an argument.
And then what about the other things that I know? So, I mean, you talked about most of the problems that you see on the hospital ward are chronic in nature. And yeah, one could only assume that if you were to talk to those people that you're seeing on the ward in an acute situation right now, 20 years ago, then you maybe could have done a lot more good. And we talked about how nutrition is either not taught or perhaps is taught badly. What about the other things that I've figured out are really important, like, say, stress management or sleep? How much time do you spend learning about those things?
So we'll start with sleep. Sleep is more focused upon by the medical school because it has kind of a scientific basis, a longer scientific basis than stress management or mindfulness. So we'll learn about the different wavelengths or the kind of the frequencies of the brain during sleep, and then the different REM, non-REM sleep, and then how that affects us and how we can treat conditions like narcolepsy or other sleeping conditions, and how sleep's involved in memory formation as well. So it's all very based in, it's very much based in science. We're not taught about how that relates to a patient. We're told that if you're sleep deprived for long enough, you will die. But not that chronic sleep deprivation over a number of years will increase your risk of cancers or metabolic disease. We're not taught anything like that. So that's still to come, I think, within medicine.
What do you mean, within your career in medicine or within the career in general, the curriculum?
Both.
Both.
Yeah, I know that sleep is definitely getting bigger. So you've had a podcast with Doc Barsley, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah, so I listened to that. That was really fascinating. And that just hammered home to me how important sleep was. But I think within the normal population, people don't see sleep as essential. And especially within the medical student population, people don't see it as essential because they are very type A personalities. And they do, 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 do. And sleep is for the weak or sleep is for the dead.
So you still see that then within your fellow students at King's, that there's that attitude, you know, people are not really valuing sleep in the way that they should.
Absolutely. I think sleep is seen as a luxury and perhaps as a waste of time, depending on who's looking at it. So luxury isn't a Sunday morning lion, because throughout the week, Monday to Saturday, you've been slogging and studying or partying or whatever. And or that you've sleep is just a time where you close your eyes, because in between you're eating and sleeping, eating and studying or doing other things or in lectures and doing other fun things because you want to be alive and awake.
And do you think that translates to, you know, how the doctors interact with patients? Like, I'm just wondering what it would be like for a doctor, how sympathetic they would be towards a patient that was perhaps suffering some problems that were due to sleep deprivation when the doctor themselves is sleep deprived. I'm just wondering how that is that, am I touching on something here, or is that irrelevant?
No, it depends on the context. So we're just discovering the link between sleep and cancers and sleep and metabolic diseases. And so it's not going to be on the top of the doctor's list of things to address. They're going to be addressing the acute problem, why the patients come in and how they can treat it. And they'll be very much overwhelmed by the medical model. And so what, you've got a cancer, let's send you for a scan. Let's see how far it's progressed. Let's see what our treatment options are, whether they can give you surgery or chemo or radiotherapy. They're not going to be like, how much sleep have you been having recently? It's not on the top of the list. It's just not what they ask. If kind of in a psychiatric setting, perhaps they'd ask for sleep a bit more, because that is more based in someone's past. So if someone has a psychiatric condition, then the psychiatrist would be more attuned to looking and digging up what's gone on in the person's previous lives. And so sleep may, it's not going to be on the tip of people's tongues when they take a history.
And then what about the mindfulness? It's kind of interesting to me that, you know, because I think there's a great deal of scientific evidence to support mindfulness practices or guided meditation. There's a whole bunch of different things that work.
Yeah.
And the risk of that intervention or recommending that intervention is basically zero, right? You're not going to really, there's no chance of you really hurting someone by recommending that they do some guided meditation. But does that ever come up in medical school?
You know what? I really like the idea of meditation and mindfulness. And it is just taking off now. So at King's, in the last year, I've met a few different doctors who've kind of opened up and said they like meditating, which is interesting because it's meditation's kind of one of those things that's associated with spirituality and woo-iness, if I say it like that. In terms of, in crude terms, it doesn't fit with the medical model of you've got something wrong with you, let's fix it. I'm not sure how to describe it more fully without sounding offensive. But, you know, like, mindfulness is a very private practice. People will sit on their own or with other people, and then they just think about, or they try not to think, or they just address their thoughts and their worries. It's very personal.
Right.
We don't like that in our conservative British society, I suppose, and it doesn't fit well with the medical model, as I said previously. And so it's not something that we talk about. However, it's changing because I've met other doctors who've been doing it recently, and they say they've got much benefit. If you're stressed, I know the benefit personally, and I know family members who do it too. And so it seems really important to me. And I'm happy that it's increasing within medical school. So at King's, you've got this one really good lead clinician of, I think she's a fifth year. She's one of the fifth year teachers. So medical students who are coming to the end of their exams, the end of medical school, they're really stressed. And she's very pro-mindfulness and mindfulness-based activities to deal with stress and make yourself feel better. So there's now a mindfulness society. So people get together and meditate. And it's led by this woman. And there's a mindfulness SSC. So an SSC is a student selected component, and it's an extracurricular compulsory activity that you have to do. And so it can either be based in a lab, it can be based, so you're doing research in a lab, you could be doing a library project where you're researching an area that's interesting to you. So for example, I did an essay on hyperbaric oxygen therapy and traumatic brain injury because it was interesting. But if you're interested in mindfulness, then you can partake in this SSC that's learning about how to address stress, how to do all the different techniques of mindfulness, with the intention of benefiting that medical student themselves and benefiting patients as well. Unfortunately, it's just come in now, and I don't have any more SSCs, so I can't do it. But I know people who are lining up to do it in the future who are younger than I am.
Interesting. So that sounds a bit more promising then than the either the sleep or the diet components.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely got its niche in medicine because people are so stressed.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. And what about movement? So I know this is a particular area of interest for you, the strength and conditioning, and I just sometimes wonder about, you know, some of the old people that you see on the street and, you know, how it might come to an end for them. And I particularly worry about the injury of breaking a hip in your 60s, 70s, 80s, however old you get to be, and the role that strength training might play in preventing that type of injury. And again, of course, you've got to get to the person. It may not be any use to say to a 70-something-year-old, oh, you need to start doing deadlifting. So tell me about, you know, what you've learned about strength and conditioning and where you learned it and, you know, how we can help people with it. Such a broad question. Yeah, I apologize for the broadness of the question.
So strength and conditioning is an interest that I have from my background. It's what I like to do. I like training in, I've got a really good gym in Peckham that I go to. And we just built a gym at home for my dad and for my
mum. There you go. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That is exactly what I'm talking about. That's what I need to do for my mum is build her, something that she can use.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So I know that strength and conditioning is really important because of my background and I know how it correlates to function. The blog post I wrote on strength and conditioning research was really interesting because it's, for me it was, because something like a broken hip is so common. When people get older, and it's almost accepted as a normal process of aging that you become weaker and you lose your energy and you lose your ability to move around and become and be independent, and then you just fall over and then you break your hip and then you're taken to hospital.
And then what are your chances of surviving that injury once you're in hospital with a broken hip age 70?
The mortality rates are high, morbidity is high as well, because you end up having a little old person who hasn't got much muscle mass stuck in a hospital bed waiting for their hip to heal. And when you're lying down on a bed waiting for your hip to heal, your muscles fade away as well. You're not using them at all. And so it's just an accident waiting to happen. So you've got a person who's already weak, then they break their hip. You put them in a bed, they get even weaker, and then you tell them to get up and walk around again. They'll fall again, and then it's kind of a slippery slope downwards. Mm-hmm. Then you've got also the implications of surgical and medical. So the process of going through surgery is very traumatic, and you may lose blood, and it's very stressful for the body. So that could be a factor that really harms people. And then when you're in a hospital environment, you always run the risk of having an infection and other problems. It's just not a nice area to be in.
So I'm just wondering how much of this is taught at medical school. Are you you said that most of the doctors will become general practitioners, and I think we're both agreed that strength training could be a really powerful prescription, slightly more risky than the mindfulness practice, right? You could put your back out or something doing a deadlift.
Mm.
But it's still a lot of gain for the risk. So I'm just wondering how likely it is that those GPs that are going through King's are going to learn strength and conditioning as something they could prescribe.
Yeah, you're right. So we've got one lecturer who's pretty cool. He's a sports and exercise medicine doctor, and he is based at UCL, so one of our rival universities. But he comes to King's and gives us lectures each year. So to explain this, King's has a spiral curriculum. So something that you learn in the first year will be built upon in the second year and then subsequently be built upon in the third year. So on the first year, we were given a lecture on the benefit of exercise, and then next one would be like how to implement exercise, and then the last one would be exercise prescription, things like that. So we do have exposure to exercise, but the flaw in that approach is that you've had around a year in between each dose, and so each dose is nothing, ends up being very, very little. And a takeaway message isn't necessarily had. So for the generations going through the medical school or medical schools around the country, I don't think they are going to necessarily learn the importance of exercise and strength training as a preventative treatment. I think I'm not sure about the GP setting and whether they have more training because once you've decided to become a GP, you're pretty much a captive population, and then they can teach you more thoroughly. I do know that there's an exercise prescription initiative. So at some of the gyms in South London that I've been to, you can see like there are exercise prescription forms that a GP could fill in for a patient.
Oh, really?
And then they go to the gym. So that's the start of something, I guess. But I don't know the statistics when it comes to compliance, whether GPs are prescribing it in the first place, whether they know who to prescribe it to, how much funding there is behind it, and whether the patient they prescribe it to will act upon it and go to the gym, and then subsequently whether they'll have any benefit to it from it even. So I think it exists. I think it's something that's should increase.
It sounds promising, actually. It sounds more promising than the diet piece to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure why that is.
I mean, there's all kinds of historical and political reasons, probably.
Mm.
But tell me about your future goals. So what's your plan? Are you going to become a general practitioner? Are you going to become a sports medicine specialist? Are you going to do a PhD? What's next for you?
That's a huge question.
I know. Another. I like my huge and broad questions.
Yeah. You know what? I'm not really sure. I'm always for goal setting, but there are just so many things that are going on right now. I'm not quite sure where I see myself in the future. So I don't know if people on your side of the ocean understand what's going on in the NHS, but the NHS is going through many changes currently to its...
Oh yeah, tell us about this. So for people listening, a lot of people won't know what the NHS is. The NHS is the National Health Service in the UK. So in the UK, you pay tax and they use it to spend it on healthcare so that you actually get something for your tax dollars. Whereas that's something that doesn't happen in the US. You have to pay $1,000 a month for health insurance here. So There's kind of a big difference between the US and the UK. So tell me about the changes that are happening in the NHS.
Yeah, so the NHS is great, and it's one of the most brilliant British institutions. So the whole idea that you can get free healthcare no matter who you are and to no matter to what cost is really fantastic.
If they would let me, when I break I break my wrist or I break my ankle on my mountain bike, if they would let me board an aeroplane, go back to the UK to get it treated, that would actually be a cheaper, it wouldn't be a better, but it would be a cheaper a treatment option for me than having, even with health insurance, right? You still get landed up with this huge bill.
No way.
For the treatment. But yeah, sorry to interrupt you. Tell me about the changes that are happening.
The government is, so the NHS, because it's such a large organization, it has a huge bill and it's getting worse as the population increases and chronic disease increases. And we have an elderly population that's increasing because of the baby boom back in the 60s. So many people are coming in with diseases that have been brewing for a long time and needing treatment. So the costs of the NHS are rising very rapidly. So in an attempt, I think, to reduce the cost of the NHS, so the government are trying to decrease pay for the people working in the NHS and then increase hours, so trying to make it work better for longer for less money. The government proposed that the NHS only actually works for 5 days a week and on the weekend it doesn't exist, which is not necessarily true. If you go into A&E on the weekend, then you will have treatment, right, and there will be doctors. Like it's not non-existent. It's not like shut up shop. So that's one of the issues that we have, is that the NHS already is a 7-day service and the requirements that this contract is suggesting that doctors do is going to work them very hard, and then reducing the amount of pay they have will make life difficult and will change many people's plans for their life in terms of having a family and where they can live and then all the things they want to do within their life. So yeah, it's just unsettled people quite a lot. And so that's on a very superficial basis. You probably need to look into it more to get a full explanation. And then there's all these conspiracy theories about why the government's doing it. And that's basically going down the route of privatization. So because the NHS is so expensive, then it perhaps is a cheaper option to let external companies take a role and control sections of healthcare, much like the American system.
There's a fundamental difference, actually, as well as the fact that the care is provided directly by the government or paid for, and that's that there's a budget, right? In theory, there is a budget that goes into healthcare, whereas in the US, there isn't, right? It's like an industry. It doesn't really have a cap. So it doesn't matter. The cost could keep spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
And maybe eventually the whole country will go bankrupt, but it wouldn't be immediately apparent that you're over your budget.
I think the main objection that doctors have with the contract is that they're going to be working a lot more and they're going to be very, very, very tired. They're already tired. And if you make a workforce that's already working hard work harder, you're going to increase the rate of errors, and increasing rate of errors means more patient harm and more patient deaths, and then you end up having an inefficient or immoral health service where it's not helping people as it should.
So what's your plan then to avoid the NHS completely and come and do some functional medicine training in the US or what?
I'm going to stay in the NHS. My plan is to stay in the NHS for the first 2 years at least, because I've done my years of medical school, you graduate as a doctor, but then you need to practice within a hospital setting to get your GMC license. So GMC is the General Medical Council, and that means that you're a proper, like, official practicing doctor, and then you can do whatever you can do. Practice where you like within the UK. So I'd like to get that because it increases my options. If I return to the UK, if I happen to travel abroad, then it means that I can jump back into the NHS and work again. I'd like to do some further education at some point. Tommy Wood is particularly inspiring with his PhD in neonatal metabolism. So I think it'd be really nice to, really, really good to be able to take some time out and do some research and learn more about an area that's interesting to me. So it allows me to differentiate myself and differentiate my career. It's also nice to be able to take time out to follow other projects too. So I'm definitely interested in functional medicine. I'm definitely interested in diet and injuries, for example. If I had the opportunity to do a study into tendon injuries and a high fat, low carb diet, then I'd...
Oh, that would be interesting. I like that.
Yeah. So I'd really like to do some research down that.
Yeah. Little Dicky Bird told me that Professor Kieran Clark at Oxford University said that you could do a PhD under her. And is that something that interests you?
Yeah. Well, I was looking for something to do. I was a bit bored. And I was just looking at all the opportunities that Oxford had on the website. And then I came across this really cool program. It's a master's or a PhD in ketosis and performance. It was just really, really interesting because I'm interested in diet and performance. I know that some of the cyclists are using exogenous ketones, like ketone esters, to give them a boost. And it's something that I'd like to explore more.
And I just interviewed Professor Kieran Clark for the Keto Summit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so she showed me some very interesting data during our talk. She actually shared a screen and showed some data in elite British rowers. And there were two time series, some rowers that did some rowing and some rowers that remained sedentary. And then she showed what happened with the plasma beta hydroxybutyrate based on the ketone ester supplement that she'd given to the rowers. And I'm not going to spoil it. You're going to have to find the link for the Keto Summit in the show notes for this podcast and sign up to see the whole interview. It's not very long. It's only about 40 minutes long, the whole interview. But I think she's doing some really, really interesting work with the exogenous ketone. So yeah, that'd be fun. I was hoping you could explain to me how ketones affect the delta G of ATP and maybe give that to our listeners.
Oh God, I've got no idea. You should have asked Kieran Clark.
Yeah, you're right. I should have asked Kieran Clark, but I was too afraid to because I knew that I wouldn't really understand the answer and I wouldn't be able to follow up with a meaningful question. I'm just kidding with you. But yeah, no, I think it's a really exciting area. I mean, you know, for people listening to this, you should check out, I'll link to it in the show notes. There have been two podcast interviews with Dominic D'Agostino. One was on the Quantified Body podcast. And then there was another on podcast STEM Talk with Dominic D'Agostino, both of which were fantastic. And the applications for these exogenous ketones, I think, are really exciting. And I'll be interviewing Dominic for the Keto Summit very soon. So yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting area of research. And I certainly would be drawn to that if I was you.
Yeah, I haven't quite cracked my own ketotic diet.
Oh, really? You've been experimenting with it then? It's like interesting enough for you to experiment with it.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's always sold as the diet that helps you concentrate and eliminates highs and lows with your blood sugar and things like that.
So that's your application. I always think it's important to have an application, you know, when you don't just do ketosis for no reason. Yeah. Like there has to be an application. So that's the application for you. Like, I guess you're sleep deprived. You need to concentrate harder. You need to get through these exams. So how has it been? Has it helped you at all?
I'm already quite biased towards high fat, low carb, and intermittent fasting as well. So I find that my concentration is definitely highest when I'm fasting. I find it difficult to get into ketosis because I don't know, I just never really got into it. That's the thing. Right. When I exercise, I end up having this taste of my breath, which I assume is some low-level ketone production, but I haven't got a ketone meter to quantify.
Oh, yeah, so you've got to measure blood ketone to know what's going on, really.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the next thing on my purchase list with my student loan.
Oh, no, I feel terrible. Like, you can't be spending your student loan on $5 beta-hydroxybutyrate strips. That's awful.
Quite expensive, yeah. I bought a blood glucose monitor just for fun. That's good. Just to see how I can track it throughout the day and when I have a meal and when I wake up with my cortisol spike in the morning, whether it's high or low and things like that. A ketone meter is definitely what I'd like to get next. Yeah, so I haven't really been able to get into full ketosis. I've just been, I'm not sure why. I can eat low carb, I can eat no carb, but I usually feel really crappy before I feel any benefit. And then compounded with training as well, so going to the gym or running, I'm always tempted by the... buy a sweet potato.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, especially when you're doing, I mean, so you mentioned CrossFit football, and I know you're a strength race kind of guy, and I don't think there's anything wrong with being scared of a sweet potato, especially if you don't really have an application. For me, it's just been, you know, so wonderful as an endurance athlete on the mountain bike. I can't, you know, it's worth it. I can use discipline to avoid the delicious sweet potato, and that kind of that pays dividends for me. But I'm not sure that's a very good general recommendation for anybody listening to the podcast.
I'd also like to do more research before I fully embrace it. So I saw Dr. Tamsin Lewis podcast on the HPA axis and how that's affected by carbohydrate availability and caloric availability. So I'd like to make sure that I'm going to be intact and hormonally intact if I attempt something more severe.
Difficult for me to summarize this, but yeah, that's basically been the whole purpose of the Keto Summit, is to get all of these people, 33 of these experts, and try and figure out what are the benefits, what are the applications, what are the pitfalls? How are people going wrong with this thing? And, you know, maybe I can create a resource that can avoid these problems for people in the future, you know, just by getting the information together in one place.
Absolutely. I think, so I'd like a meter, but I'd also like more sophisticated testing too, so I can kind of track real time. So I know that you do the Dutch testing.
Yeah, we're doing all kinds of testing as well. So that's the thing. So for people that we work with in our practice, we're not just doing, you know, blood beta-hydroxybutyrate. We're also looking at, you know, 75 marker blood chemistries, and then another 75 markers on the urinary organic acids, and then more urinary metabolites in the hormone test, the Dutch. And then we're also doing stool tests. So it's not like we're not seeing how the impact of low carbohydrate is affecting the rest of the biochemistry and the physiology. We absolutely do. So yeah, it may turn out to be important to have that extra information, and maybe I'll know more about that once I finish the Keto Summit.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to get to grips with before I take it any further. I'm quite happy with my current approach. I feel good, and I can concentrate, and I can still exercise, which is good.
Well, this has been great, Rory. I will link to your blog. So I think you're a really great writer, actually. I'm quite impressed by your writing. Like, I'm actually, the thing I'm most impressed with is the fact that you find the time and energy to maintain a blog whilst going through medical school. I think is quite extraordinary. So I will, of course, link to your blog. And then you've also been doing some writing for strengthandconditioningresearch.com.
Yeah.
And I'll link to, in particular, I read your article on strength and conditioning and bone density, which I thought was really interesting. So I'll link to that in the show notes so that people can read that article.
Awesome.
Is there anything else that people should know about you?
If you're in the UK and you want to, or anywhere, I suppose, in the world, and you want to learn more about resources that you could have if you're a general practitioner regarding exercise and diet, then you should check out the MoveEatTreat.org website. It's got a whole load of resources that a few doctors have curated as a general approach to try and reduce chronic disease within the community. So it's trying to make it accessible mainly for healthcare professionals, so doctors and GPs, people who work in hospitals and in the community who are seeing patients on a regular basis. And then it's also worded well enough so that lay people can read it as well. And hopefully it covers kind of diet, exercise and mindfulness as well. It's really, really good.
Interesting. Move, Eat, Treat. I will link to that in the show notes. And then also for people, if you've got any questions about the type of testing that we do at Nourish, Balance, Thrive, you can actually come to the front page of my website and there's a button there. You can book a free consultation. And I'm off to the BC bike race in Canada, so it'd be quite hard to get hold of me for the month of July. But you will be able to get hold of my colleague, Amelia Luca. She has all the same functional medicine training that I do. And you can talk to her about your problems and how the testing might be able to solve them. And then also we do diet and lifestyle coaching, obviously. So that's the main way in which we see improvement on the lab results. And we've been getting fantastic results. So yeah, come to the front page, nourishbalancethrive.com, book a free consultation. And Rory, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, I wish you the best of luck at medical school. I think you're doing an amazing thing, and I wish you all the best.
Thanks very much.